Short and sweet. That's what we've done with this episode of the Vermont Edition podcast. I'm Matthew Smith, producer of Vermont Edition, and I wanted to say thanks for listening, and we hope you enjoy.
This is Vermont Edition. I'm Jane Lindholm. As the Scott administration gradually relaxes restrictions in Vermont, there may be even more questions than there were before about health and safety and appropriate protocol. Today, as we do every Monday right now, we're going to get a health update from state health officials and others. We're going to spend most of the hour talking with Deputy Health Commissioner Tracy Dolan about precautions to prevent further spread of COVID-19, as well as guidelines for the places and types of gatherings that are starting to be allowed to reopen or restart. In the middle of the show, we'll also learn about a Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center program, which is investigating the use of convalescent blood plasma, the plasma of recovered COVID-19 patients, to treat the disease. First, though, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, thank you very much for making time for us again.
Thank you so much. I'm always happy to be with you.
Oh, I'm glad to hear that, because we're always happy to have you. And so are the many listeners who, as you know, have a lot of questions that remain about this. So, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, let's talk first about testing, and then we can also talk about some of the other areas that the health department is working on and working with in reopening. Who is currently being tested or advised to be tested by the state?
So currently, we are really recommending testing for, of course, anyone who has even mild symptoms. And we are pushing right now first responders, childcare workers for the essential workers, and in addition, healthcare workers.
And those three types of people that you just mentioned there, are you asking people to in those categories to get tested even if they are asymptomatic?
We are in those categories, and we've set up some clinics. So we've had some pop-up clinics. We had one on Saturday, and then we have more this week.
And these pop-up clinics, you've been training first responders in some cases to both to staff these, but also asking first responders to get tested. Are you able to find enough people currently to get to the 1,000 tests daily threshold that the health department is trying to get to?
You know, it is a challenge. I mean, you know, it's a blessing and a curse. The blessing, of course, is that we don't have very many people with symptoms in Vermont, and we have a very low incidence rate. Over the weekend, we ran hundreds of tests, and we came up with zero positive cases and zero deaths, which was good news. But on the other hand, it's not necessarily driving people to want to get tested. And so we moved fairly quickly, and we had limited time to promote this last clinic. So for the rest of the clinics this week, we're doing a lot of promotion, and we may end up broadening the audience somewhat so that we can get our numbers up really take advantage of our ability to do these testing clinics.
Yeah, when we spoke with you and state epidemiologist Patsy Kelso last week, we were talking about one of the ways that the state can try to keep an eye on the data and feel somewhat secure in understanding whether transmission is spreading more rapidly or not as things open up is by having a certain percentage of the population tested. And wasn't it something like 1% or 3% of the population daily?
Yeah, it was a fairly low number, although a high absolute number, but a low percentage. I'd have to check to see if it was 1 or 3.
Yeah, I can't remember either right this minute. But at any rate, the idea is if you're testing, you know, if you're sort of broadly testing throughout the population, and Vermont's approach is to also specifically test some of these categories where there may be more exposure, like first responders or childcare providers, that you'd have a pretty good sense of what is happening with COVID-19 transmission throughout the state. But if you're not able to get to that threshold because there just aren't enough people volunteering to be tested or in those categories or having their physicians and healthcare providers referring them for testing, does that mean that the state may not have a very good handle on the transmission rates?
I think we have a pretty good handle because we're actually doing a lot of testing in the areas that are mostly high risk. So for example, in long-term care facilities, we've been doing more testing, correction centers. So I think what we're seeing is a real reflection. However, we're not certain. And so you will see us likely ramping up testing for people who are asymptomatic as well in the coming days and opening that up. We'll just need to do some work on our end for the logistics and how that works. But right now, our first focus, and this is coming from CDC, they really lay out the priority populations for us, and we concur based on what we know here in Vermont. And then you will see likely that we will ramp up testing so we can get to those bigger numbers and really be doubly sure. It's less about being sure right now, because right now, because we haven't reopened, we feel that the incidence rate that we're seeing, which is very low, is real. However, as we open up and we have more people coming in from out of state, that's where we need better surveillance. And so having bigger numbers will help us as we move forward.
So when you say you think you'll likely expand it to more asymptomatic people, are those people likely to be in certain categories? I mean, because otherwise it's like anybody could just request, I mean, which I'm not saying the state would do, but it's sort of like, should anybody just ask to get tested when they feel like it? Like, how do you figure out which categories to push for?
We certainly first go by CDC guidance and based on their science. And so it's those where we know that the morbidity is most severe and where mortality has been high. It's also those that are interacting with patients. It's those parts of the workforce that we really rely on, particularly if we do see a spike. So those are our first priorities. And then, of course, those childcare providers. But as we move forward, we may end up opening it up and opening it up to the general public. And I think that in the coming weeks, you will see more of that so that we can get a better sense, particularly in concert with reopening. And that will allow us to do some health surveillance so that as the numbers rise, we're able to manage that. It's likely that the numbers will rise to some extent as we reopen.
And my understanding from today's press conference was also that people who are coming into the state of Vermont, or particularly because people who don't have a reason to be here because they don't live here have been asked to try not to come in. But there are many Vermonters who may be returning from out of state, and those in particular, is it true that they've now been advised that you still have to follow a 14-day quarantine, but if you've reached day 7, whether you are symptomatic or not, you can now request to be tested?
You can. Day 7 or later, you can request to be tested and we will test. And if you come back negative, then you'll be released from your quarantine. However, we have this great new tool called Sarah Alert, which allows us the technology to keep monitoring people beyond that time. And so it's not like you'll be released and then nobody will keep an eye on you. We will continue to have communication and ask people to be checking on their symptoms. And if for some reason they become sick after that, then we're able to get in contact with them again and reinstitute quarantine if needed.
And is that an approach that people who may be coming here, not to second homes necessarily, but who come every summer for a certain time or who want to be traveling into the state, that they may find that approach as well? Or are you restricting this to Vermonters returning to the state?
It's not unique to Vermonters. The issue is less about whether you're a Vermonter, although we like to think that Vermonters are just, you know, great people, and so there's something special for them. But it's really about where you're coming from, and it's about the risk. And so this is all about reducing risk. It's less about your state of birth and a lot more about risk.
As you continue to develop guidelines for overnight camps, is this an approach that you're thinking about taking for campers?
We haven't discussed that yet, but I would say in general, the colleges and universities who have been talking about people coming back have also been thinking about how they would manage it if we needed to quarantine people coming in. So I could see it being part of the way people think about child care camps or children's camps during the summer, particularly if they're residential. I don't know yet if we are going to go down the road of residential. I think that's a little bit of a wait and see this week. But if there is a situation where people are coming in from out of the state for residential, there would certainly be something in place that would allow us to closely monitor. So that's an uncertain one that we can get back to you on next week in terms of residential for summer camps.
Great. I think, yeah, lots of people looking for guidance on that and childcare centers. AHS Secretary Mike Smith said Wednesday or Thursday there should be more information coming about the reopening of childcare centers. Does that jive with what you're working on with the health department?
Yeah, we have a team here. Our head pediatrician, our maternal child health head, Dr. Breena Holmes, is part of that team. And so she's busily working on it, trying to get as many perspectives as she can. The team looks to other states because we are all learning as we go. There are a lot of calls with CDC, with school health teams from across the country to determine how best to have the science lead our approach. And so we're looking at any and all options. We definitely want to be able to help kids get into activities. I know it's hard for parents and it's really hard for kids. I mean, this is part of how they grow and develop. It's one thing for adults to be inconvenienced and, of course, to be out of work And it's another thing for kids not to get what they need developmentally. And so we're doing everything we can to figure out how do we balance that with health and safety.
Deputy Commissioner, we've gotten more questions about masks, continuing questions about masks, and some guidance from the governor today in the press conference. But let me ask specifically about something that Health Commissioner Dr. Levine said during the press conference that was news to me, and I heard from some other listeners as well that this was the first time they'd heard that guidance. In talking about masks, Commissioner Levine said mask wearing is not advised. It's not advised for people with certain health conditions, children under the age of 2, and pregnant women. It was the pregnant women part that I had not heard about before. Why shouldn't pregnant people wear masks?
I had not heard about the pregnant women either. And so that is a discussion I will have with my boss later today to try to learn a little bit more about that. Certainly, we've been advocating for kids under 2 to not wear it and people with certain health conditions. And again, because we're learning all the time, this might be something new that just came out of CDC this morning that he may have seen, or there might be something else going on there. So I could start to make something up, Jane, but that's not why I'm here. So I will chat with him.
Good. If you get any information, let me know. We'll update listeners here. I mean, I certainly remember from my own 2 pregnancies an extreme shortness of breath, but I couldn't see a reason why wearing a mask would enhance that or make things more risky. So yes, when you get more information, if you let us know, we'll continue to update listeners. Also on masks, Robin wrote in to say, I think it would be a good idea to talk about wearing masks when folks go out and are around others. I go to the grocery store and I see that more than half of the people aren't wearing masks or social distancing. This seems to tell me that they don't have respect for the people around them. They're fine spreading the disease. I feel as though some people don't realize that the reason we're wearing masks is to keep us from spreading it to others. When I see people not wearing masks, it's hard to stay quiet. And then we got a different perspective from Christine, who says, as someone with severe complex post-traumatic stress disorder, I have not been able to find a face covering that doesn't trigger panic and other PTSD symptoms. I truly want to be a good community member, but I'm unable to comply with the recommendation. I've tried and tried, but after a few public panic attacks, I've had to give up. As more private businesses require masks for entry, my options for even grocery shopping are diminishing. While I understand businesses have the right to make this choice and I respect it, where does this leave people like me? And Christine goes on to say, how will I keep my budget? How will I be able to take my children to community events and activities if they take place? Or will we have to continue to be isolated? Will I be able to bring my daughter to childcare when it reopens if masks are required for pickup and drop-off? Will my job be in jeopardy if they require masks in the office? I've not heard anyone talking about the reason some people may not be able to wear masks or offering compassion and respect rather than distrust and exasperation. I am assumed to be uneducated and or willfully and selfishly putting others at risks. I know the social pressures of shame and stigma are meant to push people to comply, which is a good thing for greater public health. But right now I'm facing shame and stigma for a condition that is already shamed and stigmatized. So 2 perspectives there, both valid. But Deputy Commissioner Dolan, could you talk directly to Christine, who's just really concerned about this? And there is no mandate to wear a mask, but there certainly is social pressure. And we even hear about it from Commissioner Levine that, you know, the more social pressure, the better in some ways, because it creates more compliance.
And Christine is the second questioner who has some
PTSD. Yeah, who has
PTSD
complex PTSD,
masks.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. All of the guidance that comes out speaks to the fact that there might be some people who can't wear masks because of medical conditions. I don't know that it calls out mental health conditions. And so that might be something that's missing in the way we're talking about it. And so I think that, you know, people have to use their judgment to do their best. It might be that there are ways to modify. Maybe wearing a mask for a longer period is more difficult than wearing a mask for a very short period. Maybe some materials feel less constrictive than other materials. So there might be ways to modify it. But of course, if you absolutely can't because of either a medical condition or any type of medical condition, including PTSD or any mental health issue, I think the key would be, are you able to find neighbors who can help if you still need to get groceries, et cetera, or are you able to go in for short periods, really watch that 6-foot distancing? But as we move forward, we will have some people for a variety of reasons who may not be able to wear a mask. I'm hoping that's not the majority. I don't think it is. But I know that there is this sort of public shaming of people not wearing masks. And while the positive peer pressure is helpful, we don't want to, of course, cross that line to the point where we're ostracizing someone who may have a very valid reason for not wearing a mask.
Mental health issues is certainly one of those reasons, but there are other people who fear wearing masks for other reasons, including in some cases people who say, I don't feel comfortable because of my skin color of what others may perceive of me if I'm wearing a mask. Is that another thing that you've been considering?
You know, we have not discussed that here and we haven't heard examples of that, but I can certainly understand how that could come into play, especially with some of the very tragic news we've been hearing in the last week about perceptions and the kind of discrimination and racism that are faced by some people living in this country. And so I can understand how there could be a lot of concerns about what it says to other people and how other people may respond to a person.
Susan in Lake Elmore asks, can I wear a full face shield in place of a mask?
We're allowing that for people working in a retail store, and I saw it out and about today. We've been promoting cloth masks, so I don't want to override that order, but I would say that a face shield certainly provides some protection, and what we're getting at is some protection. So I'm going to give you a vague answer on that one right now and say that certainly some kind of facial protection is better than none, and a shield certainly provides some of that.
Deputy Commissioner, we have some questions about travel and in-state and out-of-state. Joan emailed in to say, would you consider it risky for a 78-year-old woman to travel from Vermont to Seattle beginning July 15th for 3 weeks? I made reservations in January, but I have COPD, hypertension, and two autoimmune disorders that require me to use low-dose prednisone. I've made this trip annually for years to see my daughter and grandchildren. What would you say to Joan? I know you can't offer probably direct advice, but in considering these types of questions and trying to think a couple months out, but make plans for the summer, how would you advise folks like Joan?
I think any travel plans beyond June are really something that you should consider as we move forward. So for example, right now, I actually don't know what's happening in Washington in terms of their rates, but if they're experiencing any kind of spike in July, that would be a very important consideration before someone gets on a plane or drives across the country. I am concerned with this particular caller that they may have some pre-existing conditions that already put them at risk. Certainly their age puts them at higher risk. And then travel and movement and being around other people continues to put them at risk. So even though Vermont's numbers are looking good, that is not the same with all other states. And we do have an ability, in part because we're small, we're spread out, and we started early, to do a little more containment of this transmission should it start to rise up again. I don't know that that would be the same for the place she's traveling.
While we're talking about these kinds of issues, let's go to Miriam, who's with us from South Burlington. Hi, Miriam.
Hi. I just wanted to know whether it's advisable for a family member, one that's coming from Westchester County, to come at this time, and if so, what would the recommendations be? I've heard them before. They seem to be repeated, but I guess I just need to hear it one more time.
And Westchester County, fairly New York City area. So, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, one family member coming from that area to Vermont. Are they allowed, and what do they need to do to make sure that they're staying safe?
They need to quarantine for 14 days, and after 7 days, they are welcome to ask for a test if they're coming.
And in terms of can they, should they? I mean, the state is not saying people cannot come. We know that the state police and law enforcement officials are monitoring the state borders to look at the states that the license plates are coming from to monitor this. But so you're... Do you have advisement about whether people should come or not?
Up until now, we've said if you don't need to come here, please don't. However, recognizing that we're starting to move into some reopening, that may change. And so while we don't have a hard and fast rule, we have generally discouraged people from coming in. If they are going to come in, we will ask that they quarantine. And that's a very serious recommendation to quarantine. And then after 7 days, they are able to get tested, and if they're negative, they'd be released from that quarantine. But quarantine is not the same as stay home, stay safe. quarantine means you don't leave your house.
Miriam, does that work for you? Are you able to keep your family member quarantined and, in fact, those of you who may be exposed to this family member quarantined?
I don't think he would want to do that. He just wants to come up and lend a hand in some I'm going to be doing some remodeling eventually, and he's got things that he needs to remove from here, personal things that he's had from when he was a kid. And so I need him to kind of assess that.
So Miriam, let me ask you, given the strict guidelines and the sort of pleas from the state to say, if you are coming into the state, you must quarantine and please don't come if you can't do that. Are you going to talk to your family member about that?
Yeah, I think I need to do that.
Well, thanks for the call, Miriam. I mean, it's interesting, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, it seems like, you know, that for so many of us, we all have our own personal circumstances, which are all different. And it's sort of like you look at the guidelines, you think you know how they apply to you, but you kind of need someone to say, no, please don't do that, or that's not advisable, or that's not safe for your community, in order to say, yeah, okay, you know, I understand, or yes, or not, you know, or it's going to work for me to do these certain things.
Well, and you heard the governor say several times today, you know, this isn't a perfect science, and a lot of it is not black and white, in part because the amount of time it would take for us to write up guidelines that meet every single possible variation of circumstance would be pretty tremendous. And it's hard to know the exact answer on the details. So we're hoping that the spirit of a lot of these guidelines is understood and that people apply common sense as well. And we're asking Vermonters to apply that, which they have, and which is in part why we're doing well in Vermont.
We're going to stay with Deputy Commissioner Dolan and talk more with her in a little while, but we're also going to talk with the Director of Clinical Research Unit at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center about their plasma program in just a moment. So right before we get to that, let's get one more question in here from Bernard, who's calling in from Springfield. Hi, Bernard. You have a question, right?
Hey. Yes, I do. I live in Vermont. You said the Vermont is. I go to New Hampshire with my family to shop for groceries and toiletries and stuff like that. Do we have to quarantine ourselves when we come back?
And Bernard, how far into New Hampshire are you going? You're just going across the border to shop?
Yes, it's like 20 miles from home.
Yeah, so Bernard, thanks. This is a question that's come up a couple times as well, Deputy Commissioner, and the guidelines from the state are?
The guidelines from the state are there are some exceptions to quarantine, and that's an example of an exception. If you're going across the border because that's where you normally shop and you're there for a short period, and you come back, you don't need to quarantine. I would really ask, though, that the mask wearing is important. And then let's not forget hand washing. Hand washing is one of our fundamental lines of defense in preventing the transmission of any virus. And so very important to do the hand washing when you get back, to do the social distancing, and be aware of all of that. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks for that clarification. And we wanted to take some time now to talk about an initiative at Dartmouth-Hitchcock Medical Center to evaluate the use of antibody-rich plasma to treat COVID-19. Jamie Wilson is the director of the Clinical Research Unit and Clinical Research Nursing at Dartmouth-Hitchcock. Jamie Wilson, nice to talk with you. Thanks for being with us.
Hi, Jane. Thank you for having me. Nice to talk with you as well.
So I understand that DHMC is participating in a program that will evaluate the use of this antibody-rich plasma to treat COVID-19. And you're taking the plasma from people who have had, either confirmed to have had, or my understanding is assumed to have had COVID-19. So can you start at the beginning of the process, who you're testing and what it is you're taking from people?
Yes. So plasma is the liquid portion of blood, and it's donated by COVID-positive patients, or as you said, patients who were deemed by their physicians to likely have COVID based on symptoms or if they had another positive family member in the household. So this liquid portion of the blood is extracted from the patient. They take about one pint, and that pint is divided into two units, which can treat two critically ill patients who are hospitalized with COVID-19.
So in terms of the confirmed cases, that's clear from a test. And the assumed cases, that is when their physician has said, we assume this person has it, whether they've been tested or perhaps tested negative or not.
Yep, yep. Whether if they've tested negative, then they would not qualify as a patient who likely had COVID. But if they were in a household or exposed to somebody who did test positive and are exhibiting symptoms that the physician is confident that they can deem that they likely are positive with COVID, then they would qualify.
And then are you testing for antibodies or just taking plasma?
So there's another protocol that is in the works right now where they are looking to test for antibodies, but this study is currently just taking plasma. That plasma is being tested as any other blood product would for any other disease to make sure that it's able to transfuse into a patient, and then the plasma is given to a patient inpatient in-house.
Okay, and why is plasma so important or so good?
So the plasma likely contains antibodies to the COVID virus, which may be a safe treatment option for critically ill patients. The use of convalescent plasma actually dates back to the early 1900s. It was used in the Spanish flu in 1918, which coincidentally also affected the Upper Valley, and the SARS outbreak in 2003. In both of those instances, the use was promising in treatment for patients.
Promising, but not studied enough to really have a great sense of it? I mean, this seems like a moment in time where, you know, not just DHMC, but a lot of places are working on this question, and we could have some really expanded answers to the value of antibody-rich plasma.
Yes, you're correct. So we're actually tapping into an expanded access program through the Mayo Clinic, and multiple sites in the United States are able to do this. Through patients going on this study, they're collecting some observational safety data, which will be informative as to if this treatment is feasible to continue using in the future. Other sites that have a higher population of COVID-positive patients are doing randomized clinical trials to further that research.
And you mentioned, Jamie, that you take the plasma from people who are in the program, and then you actually put it into a patient. So you're actually transferring this plasma into COVID-positive patients now?
Yes. Yep. So patients who are – the patients that receive this plasma, they're critically ill, so they're inpatient, whether that be at Dartmouth, or we've also been able to supply plasma to other facilities in New Hampshire. So the plasma is extracted from the recovered patient. It's a couple-day process to go through all of the testing and process the plasma to make sure it's safe for transfusion. And then the plasma is delivered to the floor and transfused into the patient just as any other blood product would be.
Yeah, I was going to say, you might not have enough patients at Dartmouth-Hitchcock or even in the Upper Valley to be able to just contain it to this specific region.
Right. Yep. So we've been fortunate enough to be able to supply a lot of the southern hospitals in the state as well.
And what are you observing so far?
So unfortunately, we can't really share individual patient responses due to the size of our community and patient privacy. But overall, nationally, there are some promising results. But as we spoke about previously, more research is definitely needed to have that solid answer.
So no solid answer. And understanding that caveat, what are the promising results looking like? I mean, nationally, what is the hope or what people think may happen?
Yep. So the hope is that the antibodies in the plasma, once the patient receives that, is going to help them fight the infection and be able to reverse the effects of COVID, and that patients who are admitted critically ill with a poor prognosis will actually be discharged home. Some cases we have been seen that is the case, but as with anything, you can't really come to a conclusion off of a variable of a small sample size of patients.
Mm-hmm. And Jamie, just to back up on the science of this, I mean, the idea is that if you are given antibodies that somebody else made through this plasma transfusion, if you're a very sick person and your body is working overtime to combat this virus, getting those passive antibodies may help build your response to the virus without your body having to do it because your body is really struggling already. I mean, that's not a super scientific way of putting
is
that right?
No, but that is right. Yep, it helps strengthen your own immunity to fight against the virus.
All right, so this looks promising. It's something that several different sites around the country are working on. If you are someone who is receiving the plasma, who is a critically ill COVID-19 patient, do you have to consent to this, or is this something that's just part of standard treatment?
You do have to consent to this. So if you are doing well enough that you can consent yourself, then that is how that process goes. Elsewise, the research team would work to consent a legally authorized representative or next of kin.
And what are the risks associated with it as a patient who's getting this plasma?
Whenever you're receiving a drug like this, you could have an immune response, a side effect, just like any other medication. Once a patient is infused with the plasma, they're monitored closely by the floor staff to ensure that they're not having any type of negative reaction.
And in terms of people who are donating, what's the protocol for that? And can Vermonters and New Hampshire residents who have had or who are assumed to have had COVID-19 get involved in this?
Yes, certainly. The community response around us has actually been pretty amazing. Those recovered from COVID, including DH employees, have been really eager to contribute to the potential solutions for the global pandemic. So if you're 28 days out after the resolution of your symptoms, you can call the DHMC Blood Donor Program or email them. I have those contact numbers. It would be 603-653-3775 or email dhmc.blood.program@hitchcock.org.
We'll put both of those up on our website just for people who may have missed writing them down really quickly. So you are looking for more volunteers. You are looking for people who are still willing to do this.
Yes. Yep. And when you call the blood donor program, you go through a screening process to ensure that you're eligible, and then they'll set an appointment for the patient to come in.
And in terms of, you know, what we learned from this, you're operating this this research and doing this kind of treatment, I assume, on sort of a an emergency basis that's allowed by the government. But for the future, what are we hoping to understand better that could streamline things in the future, either for a secondary surge of this illness or for other illnesses like this? As you mentioned, this was something that was used as far back as the 1918 flu pandemic.
Yeah, so if we see positive outcomes, then it just highlights the need to have this process in place as soon as possible should we see further surges. We also have other treatment studies here at Dartmouth for COVID, and through interdepartmental collaboration, it's been really integral into quickly operationalizing any of these trials in response to COVID, working very closely with med transfusion, research ops, all of the clinicians, especially infectious disease, has really allowed us to respond and provide treatments to patients as quickly as possible. So we'll be prepared to do so should there be a surge or a second rise in what we're seeing in our area.
That's Jamie Wilson, Director of the Clinical Research Unit and Clinical Research Nursing at Dartmouth Hitchcock Medical Center. Jamie, thank you very much for talking about your plasma research with us.
Yes, thank you. Thank you for having me.
Mary is on the line with us from North Hero. Hi, Mary. Go right ahead. What's your question?
Hi, Jane. This is Mary Bernie Scutell. I volunteer with the North Hero Parks and Rec. I know that Governor Scott has issued some guidelines in terms of summer camps. We run 7 summer camps for Island Tick, ages 3 to 12. And I'm not sure if we've heard the final regulations required to open the camps, whether there has to be a certain number of children, the issue about social distancing, which is difficult with 3-year-olds. For 4, 5, and 6-year-olds, and cleaning rags and all that sort of stuff. So I was wondering if Tracy Dolan, is that her name, has more information about that.
Mary, thanks for the call. Yeah, Deputy Commissioner?
Yeah, thanks for the question, Mary. The governor did speak about guidelines for the camps for this summer, and he noted that they're not out yet. We're developing them now. So hopefully those guidelines will give you some general answers about the questions you have. I would say of all the things you mentioned, probably the cleaning protocol will be the least onerous, and the most challenging will be figuring out how to comply with some of the conditions with kids in that age group. And so we have a group now thinking hard about that. We want to make these conditions something that are feasible and that also allow kids to get what they need over the summer.
Yeah, I mean, it seems tricky. It was acknowledged several times in Friday's press conference that limiting groups to 10 or fewer of anybody in a room is going to be really difficult for childcare centers and for camps, and not feasible for many of the programs to even open under those conditions. So it sounds like some of the restrictions that might be loosened are going to be things like how many people can there be in a given space. But it's hard without those, you know, without being able to know what by June 1st or July 1st is going to be allowed. It seems hard for programs to plan. So is that something that you're going to be able to sort of preview for programs that by this date we expect you'll be able to have this number? Or are they going to have to plan for 10 and then expand on the fly if and when they can?
I don't know what the number will be. I do know that we know that different groups are at different levels of risk for this particular illness, and we know that children are generally lower risk. And although we're hearing about some challenges that children are facing, based on our numbers in Vermont, we're not seeing those kinds of issues come up for children. And so we may have different rules for different kind of groups of people. You know, we're continuing to say that elderly people should stay more isolated and shouldn't have visitors, for example, right now. Whereas we said for those who are in a younger age group or who are physically very well, you know, they can gather in groups up to 10. And so you may see some changes based on the grouping, but we recognize that, you know, running a camp based on low numbers might not be financially feasible as well. So we're taking all that into account this week.
We got a note from Gio who says, I had chills, a fever, sore throat, and other flu and cold symptoms in early March. When I called my doctor, they said I likely just had a cold and that it was likely not COVID because I didn't have the shortness of breath or cough. I recovered after about 1 or 2 weeks, but I've been wondering if I had it. Is it possible for people who suspect that they had COVID but are now well to get an antibody test? And Gio specifically wrote back saying they're looking for free or low-cost antibody test anywhere in northern Vermont. Can you update us on what's happening with the state's protocol around antibody testing?
Sure. We looked into it a few weeks ago because there was talk of rolling out antibody tests across the country. And at that time, our team looked at it and determined that the sensitivity and accuracy of the test was limited. Since then, the World Health Organization has also come out and others with similar conclusions. There have been some people who have been infected, got better, received an antibody test that said they were fine, and then became reinfected. And it was determined that the antibody test was actually inaccurate. I should clarify. So not necessarily were sick, but who received an antibody test assumed that they had it and were protected and then later became infected. And so I think there are some concerns about the antibody tests, and an antibody test with a low reliability would be a challenge because it wouldn't be much use to us if we had to go ahead and confirm each time than with our own COVID-19 test.
Well, and in fact, last week, the FDA tightened restrictions on the emergency use of antibody testing because it had allowed these to sort of go out much more freely. But Abbott Laboratories said today that it has been granted emergency use authorization for its new coronavirus antibody test and says it can ship close to 30 million tests this month and as many as 60 million tests shipped out worldwide next month. Is this something that you think the Vermont Working Group is going to look into?
I'm sure they will. They're looking into everything as it comes forward. Our preference is that the FDA would take some leadership and actually choose a test and say, this is the one that makes sense. This is the one with the best reliability.
And you don't think that's what the FDA is saying by authorizing this emergency use?
I'm not certain. We've had more than one company talk about emergency use, and some companies saying there's a particular lab that's been approved. And so we're watching it carefully. And that group is meeting in the next week again to determine the role of antibody testing. And not that it's not important, it is, but right now our focus is on testing and contact tracing so we can get a sense of a baseline as well.
The FDA has also now allowed the emergency authorization of antigen testing. Can you describe the difference between antigen and antibody testing?
I will actually defer to one of our epidemiologists, and we'll come back to that. You will find that I am I'm pretty limited in how I'm going to answer that. So if callers call in to ask anything deeper than that, I will be stuck. So I'll come back to you on that one.
All right. So we'll talk about antigen testing at a further date. And let's go back to our calls because we have a lot of people with questions about, you know, what should they do in other circumstances and scenarios. And actually, we'll go to Anne, who emailed in first. Anne says, I'm pregnant. I'm due at the end of June. My mother is going to be part of our plan for childcare while I'm giving birth and for postpartum support. She and my father are naturally quite isolated in their daily life. Is there anything she should do in preparation for coming to my home before or at the time of delivery? Should she consider getting tested before coming to our home? If so, how close to my due date should she get tested? And should my husband or 3-year-old daughter also get tested prior to my being admitted to the hospital? As the pregnant mother, I will be tested upon entering labor and delivery, and I'm currently furloughed with the plan to stay out of work until after maternity leave. All right, so there were lots of questions in there, but two primary ones are, you know, who should get tested and when? And Anne doesn't say whether her mom is living out of state or in Vermont, and that might make some difference in the actual state advisory around a 14-day quarantine upon entering the state. But what about family members of a pregnant person getting tested?
Yeah, assuming they're all in Vermont, we don't have any unique guidance for family members of a pregnant person. Again, because a newborn is particularly vulnerable, generally we encourage people to be very thoughtful around who's around their baby and really encourage a lot of hand washing, et cetera. And especially at this time, you may want to limit some of the contacts for the newborn child. However, there are no unique testing guidance that says, for example, that grandparents would need to get tested before taking care. But again, really thinking about hand washing, really thinking about if you're sick, stay away, and all of those pieces.
But given the fact that we were talking at the very beginning of the show about the idea that the state is not really able yet to reach its threshold of 1,000 tests a day, because you don't actually have that many people who are either advised or requesting to get tested, is this the kind of scenario where a health official might say, you know, a doctor, a physician treating Anne might say, yes, I'm going to recommend that your whole family get tested, and that's something the state would consent to?
If a physician recommends that people get tested, for the most part, we have agreed to that. And so if there was a reason that a physician was concerned and wanted to recommend this particular family to get tested, I can imagine that that would work out very well. In addition, as we move forward with ramping up testing, we may end up opening it up in some communities. And so that could be another opportunity. But at this time, there isn't a particular risk. And so we're not putting out particular guidance around the need for family members of a pregnant person to get tested prior to the birth of the child.
And just to wrap up with Anne, should anything her mom should do in preparation for coming to Anne's home for the child care piece?
If she's out of state, she should come early and she should quarantine away from the child and baby for at least 7 days until a test is available. I would say that's very important.
Melinda is calling from Burlington. Hi, Melinda.
Hi there. I live in co-housing in Burlington, and that's a congregate living situation where there are 18 condo units in a large common house. But in 15 of these units, many of us are over 65, and some of us have the chronic situations, you know, the COPD, diabetes. And we've been really careful because we're really cooperative here. We've disinfected surfaces and haven't allowed people into the residential areas and wear masks and sew masks. However, now some of the families really want to have their friends and family visit them in their condos. But that would mean allowing outsiders into our, you know, careful community here, going through the private residential hallways where our condos are. And any guidance would be appreciated because I'm a retired nurse and people look to me for answers.
Melinda, thanks for the call. Tracy Dolan.
You know, Governor Scott talked last week about the ability for some people to get together with trusted friends and family. And so it might be that if you're in a congregate living setting with some elderly people and people with chronic conditions, it might make more sense for that individual to go and visit with their family members in a different house versus have people come in. Because you're right, it really does increase exposure possibly to everyone in your unit unless you're able to really isolate that contact and that visit. So depending on the health of the person and assuming they're well and that they follow all the other precautions, it might make more sense for an individual in that setting to go to someone else's home.
Terry in Manchester says, why can furniture only be delivered curbside and not in the house? I ordered and paid for a mattress before the stay-at-home order, and I'm still being told only curbside delivery. There's no way I can carry that mattress myself to my second-floor bedroom. Why can I go into a hardware store and grocery store, but a person can't deliver my mattress even if I wear a mask and keep 6 feet apart? I can't be the only one in this situation. Now, Deputy Commissioner Dolan, I know that is probably not a health department protocol question, but you know, there are a lot of people who are saying this is allowed but not this, and this but not this, and why this, but and what about, you know, I have this need for this thing. I mean, how do you answer somebody like Terry?
Yeah, you know, I would probably go back to the spirit of what we're trying to do here and encourage people to use common sense to talk to whoever they're engaged with in business and think through how do we maintain some of these principles in a way that works. Now, for example, if Home Depot or Ashley Furniture, or I'm throwing out brand names, I'm probably not even allowed to do that. But if there's some company that has a policy that says when we deliver, we're not going in, well, that might be that company being really aware and concerned about the health of their staff. You may see that ease up too as we get to a better place in Vermont and as we look at ways to allow people to operate better. Certainly from the state of Vermont, we haven't said somebody can't come in and deliver your mattress. And there are ways, of course, to reduce that as well, to reduce that risk.
Let's see if we can squeeze one more call in here from David in West Halifax. David, can you make it concise?
Yes. We came from out of state 8 weeks ago. We quarantined for 2 weeks. We've been practicing really strong social isolation since then. Are we still eligible to get tested if we wanted to?
And so you've done 2 weeks of quarantine?
We're here 8 weeks. We did 2 weeks of quarantine at the beginning.
All right. So you've been here 8 weeks. What about it, Tracy Dolan?
I would reach out and try to register for one of the clinics that are popping up and see how that goes.
Even though they've been here for 8 weeks?
Yeah. I mean, so this is the ideal, right? The testing is really for those who are looking for this 7 days or beyond. So I don't think that you're in one of the high priority categories. So I guess what I'm encouraging you to do is give a call and ask, and the team may be able to help you determine that answer. But on the face of it, it's not required. It sounds like you have a desire for it. And so you may be able to call and provide that condition and see what they say.
Are you finding, Deputy Commissioner, that as you know, as Governor Scott calls it, the spigot, as the spigot gets turned a quarter turn and there are new guidelines for what can and can't open, that there are, I mean, I seem to see this, but that there are, in fact, more questions than there are answers with each turn of the spigot because there are so many more gray areas that are opened up to question.
There are. And of course, there are inconsistencies throughout because we're building this as we go. And one piece of guidance might have a slightly different detail than the next. And that's where we're just doing our best to try to correct it as we go and also asking people to apply common sense and really stick with the principles of what we're trying to do, even if the words might catch you up.
That's Tracy Dolan, Deputy Health Commissioner for the state of Vermont. As always, we really appreciate you taking the time to answer our questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Jane.